This is 90.7 FM WGXC Accra, Hudson, Catskill, the station that everyone loves.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Lynn Sloniker of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Waveforms WGXC needs you.
Good evening, radio listeners, and welcome to Musical Ecologies, the Musical Ecology series on the airwaves. This is a monthly symposium on music and sound. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and we're coming to you live tonight from the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Just a little after 8 p.m. in New York City. Tonight, my guest is sound artist, experimental musician, audio engineer, curator, writer, educator, Bob Bellaroux. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Bob. We're grateful to our broadcast partner, Wavefarm, for bringing this event to you live via WGXC FM 90.7. Radio for Open Ears in New York, Upper Hudson Valley, and online at wavefarm.org. And we want to also acknowledge that the Old Stone House, where we're broadcasting from, sits on Lenape land, traditional Lenape land, and we pay our respect to the Lenape ancestors, past, present, and future. Okay, we'll be here with you for the next 2 hours with a mix of conversation and live music with Bob Bellaroo. Stay with us. Okay, we're back. And welcome again, Bob Bellaroo, to the Old Stone House.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And so tonight is our third and final spring radio event on the Musical Ecology Series. And it's a thrill to have you here. And we got a lot of things planned here. So you're coming down here tonight from Ridgewood, is that right?
Yep.
That's where you're living now, Ridgewood, Queens.
Yep.
Representing Queens, and well, great. Well, so I guess where should we start? So how have you been managing here in the pandemic? I guess that's certainly we can't get that off our minds. We still have to talk about that. So how's it been for you?
It's weird. It's been okay. I've had a time to reflect and slow down and kind of adjust. I've been lucky and having work and being able to get by and being able to survive with less social activity. And so I've had a chance to work on more at home on recordings and just navigate things with my son and deal with, you know, school life and look out for friends and family.
Excellent. Well, yeah, well, it's certainly been a time to reflect. And you said you've been working. So part of your life is a audio engineer, right? Is that the kind of work you've been managing to keep up with some activity, some remote virtual events and that sort of thing?
Yeah, audio engineering, live streaming. I mean, I typically do like event production, but have segued to some kind of like video shoot and live stream production and management for Issue Project Room. And also, I mean, early on, I was lucky that music projects were also helping keep me afloat with the changes going on, that I was lucky to get, like, a grant for a recording project, and then also some of those, like, COVID artist grants and things like that. And so the thing that I've always, in a way, like, avoided pushing myself to try to make a living as a composer, as a musician, you know. But in a way, that those are the things that help keep me going, you know, little gigs here and there, little commissions and stuff like that.
Right. Well, good. Well, yeah, well, there's definitely a different, there's been a different type of activity going on. Well, I'm glad you've been keeping up with something. So good. Well, let's talk, you know, before I want to learn a little bit more about those, you know, some of your current projects. You said you've been recording some things and getting some grants, but I want to just kind of set the stage a little bit for our listeners, a little bit about your work and kind of sketch it out a little bit. Now, I've known your work for some years now, but still have a lot of questions, but I guess broadly, I think a big part of what you pursue in music and sound is what we would probably broadly call noise, at least in some way. So I wanna start there, and just kind of take a look at noise as an art form, as an experience, and get your sense of what noise is to you and how that. You know, how you pursue it and interrogate that, if you could.
Yeah, noise is a weird term. But to me, it's also, it's kind of more importantly a process about being open to sounds, discovering sounds, and, you know, creating sounds in new ways. I mean, I sometimes try to figure out my obsession with that. You know, I'm primarily a feedback artist, but I also work with field recordings and then just kind of unintentional artifacts, glitches, and extreme kind of recording, mixing techniques. So, you know, as a child, I was really into Jimi Hendrix and a lot of the acid rock and punk had a lot of the same, you know, aesthetic elements going on, out of control, and DIY electronic kind of creations. But then for a long period when I was on the West Coast, after my car stereo had been stolen many times, I just like lived without a car stereo for 10 years. And so everywhere I went, I just listened to the sound of the road. And, you know, so I also think about that, how that just being open to the broadband noise of existence and of motion and, know, the pressure from wind in windows and outside of, you know, bodies and such. Sometimes, you know, think of that as a root.
Well, there's a real sort of elemental, you know, visceral sort of quality about a lot of your work, especially, at least, you know, in my experience with your, with some of your live performances, when things really, you know, there's a lot of volume typically. So there's kind of an elemental sort of aesthetic, I guess you could say. I mean, it's kind of echoing what you were just describing about your time in the West, and I hear that in your music.
Yeah, the visceral experience is important. I mean, that's, you know, something you find throughout a lot of the noise world, and is just the extreme amounts of amplification and big PAs and, you know, sound that you really feel. And certainly there's intellectual aspects to it. There's musical, there's, you know, songwriting and noise, but kind of the one recurring thing is just as loud as possible. You know, it's definitely one of the catchphrases of the greater noise genre. Yeah,
for sure. Well, how did you come to noise then? I mean, more specifically, I mean, apart from these sort of abstract influences, I mean, you know, you have kind of an interesting biography. I mean, one thing that I'm particularly intrigued by is the time you spent at the Naropa Institute. So I gather. Well, that's a different kind of world from music, or at least somewhat different. And I'm wondering how you got from studying, I guess, literature and poetics in a Buddhist institute to making noise music, or what the interplay was there. You know, maybe you could just kind of sketch out a little of the timeline.
Well. The timeline's not little, but I'll sketch it out. you know, from, you know, punk music, like listening to Crass, The Feeding of the 5,000, and getting introduced to music concrete and extended music techniques, but not knowing that there was a name for it. To me, it was just this weird punk band and Jimi Hendrix and feedback. And then getting to know actual, you know, musicians, being part of a scene in San Diego, getting some chops and doing live sound and playing in bands and being around people making really kick-ass music, but who were just doing it for their friends. They were just like one-upping each other and kind of a friendly, you know, kind of repartee of community building and later on becoming, you know, successful touring bands and Crash Worship, you know, like real physical, visceral, intense, like full body experience. That all predated, you know, Poetics and Naropa and for me. But at Naropa, I was able to spend time in a recording studio and get into also like theatrical, technical work and more serious sound engineering and also playing gamelan music, which like influenced me a lot in terms of like the dedicated discipline required to make it, even though like I make music that's completely different than that, you know, that's almost like I have almost make music that has no notes in a way, and gamelan is just full of notes, but
sure.
But there's so many, and the unity of all the players together, you know, creates this one massive creation. So I take inspiration from that, and also just certainly the gongs and the amount of the heavy sound of metal. And
right. Well, so there was a gamelan ensemble in Boulder or associated.
Yeah,
with
Ed
Naropa,
and there's also a group in Denver, Tunas Mekar, and we went to Bali and played in the Bali Arts Festival, and got to see kind of a side of the island that you don't often see when you just go as a tourist.
So this was the Balinese tradition that you were part
of. Yeah, and then I later on went to CalArts and got to know a little bit of Javanese style. But I was also like in over my head learning multiple like programming languages, and just like it was just too much to keep up with. And it's like a whole way beyond a programming language, you know, in terms of kind of what you need to know, because it's kind of like, you know, this almost improvised type of process where with the Javanese, the way they kind of get into songs, sometimes the band doesn't even know what they're playing. They just kind of follow along, and then they realize it once the, you know, the one part starts to play a certain phrase.
So you're saying at CalArts you became involved in Javanese gamelan as well? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like, and because I played Balinese, they were like, "Here, do all the complicated stuff," right, and I was like, "Oh, I can't do this." Too much.
Right. So you were at CalArts in the early 2000s, is that right?
Yeah.
And who? So you were in the new media program. I see. So that was probably at that point. It was still a pretty new degree at CalArts. I was at CalArts in the early 90s. We didn't have any new media majors, but there were certainly people mixing disciplines, you know, and sort of. But so the new media program was a kind of a mix of sound and electronic and
experimental
video?
Music and software and process, that was a big important part of it. OS X came out while we were there, and I started using Super Collider there, and at the time it was a private software running in OS 9, and but we got a site license so we could use it, and then it became freeware after that. Yeah, it was strange, but I was lucky that coming in, being a little older than everyone else, they just kind of let me run wild with my ideas, and kind of I just produced a lot of work.
And who were you working with there? I mean, were you in some kind of a I don't know how the new media program worked, but you know, in the music program, you would have you would study with someone, or obviously take a lot of courses with others. But who were some of the main influences there for you?
Well, Mark Trail is my advisor, and I worked with him a lot. Tom Erb also was there, and we worked on, did some C programming with him, and also learning about recording studio. Clay Chapman was there, Sarah Roberts. She was with the Integrated Media Program, and Mort Sobotnik, too, but just strange. Mort, he's dear, but I mainly worked with him, like, learning director programming, and it was just, like, such a strange combination to have this guy who's this brilliant composer, but then, like, doing this, like, you know, language-based programming, and...
Well, I guess it was something that he knew.
he was a pioneer of... Because it was possible to do, aleatoric, nonlinear projects in it. And that's where it was coming from. But it was also then becoming, you know, World Wide Web and animation and this stuff that I just didn't really care about. But it was one of the few requirements in that program. You know, we didn't have to take music theory or practice.
Right.
And so I was able just to... I sometimes I strike through the title and just say noise, art, theory, and practice, because that's really what it was to me for being able to work there at that time.
Mm-hmm. And noise, art, theory, and practice.
Yes.
That was kind of how you described what you were pursuing there.
That's how I write it on my resume now.
That's what your sort of your thesis was, as it were, or something like that? Is that what you're saying?
That's just really what I was doing with my work.
Right.
I was doing working on installations and performances, working with live. Prior to that, I'd been more of a soundtrack artist. Like I'd been doing some live work with percussion, because that's my roots. Prior to that, like at Naropa, and later years in Boulder, but doing live electronics was definitely rooted in my CalArts years.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, good. So the noise thing, I guess, from what you're telling me so far, I mean, it seems like it has its roots earlier in your life in some kind of, you know, more in sort of a punk sort of at least the original sort of gateway, as it were. You mentioned Crass and the San Diego scene. So that's kind of your sort of entry point. Would that be fair to say? I'm just trying to understand how people get into noise. I mean, I have my own story, of course, but the
roots is, in a way, it goes more towards just DIY audio culture and mm-hmm. Producing events, running sound, making flyers,
sure,
mixtapes, mm-hmm. and along the way, then you start using equipment and things go wrong and stuff does things it's not supposed to. But I really didn't start listening to noise until like after I'd gone to Naropa and I started getting exposed to Einstürzen de Neubauten, mm-hmm. and really, because coming from a junk metal percussion background, mm-hmm. then that was like a logical next step. And then trying to amplify things, it quickly turns to feedback, which I was already a fan of. And mm-hmm. And so a lot of that, it all comes together through that.
Nice.
But it was then when I moved back to LA in late 90s where I was able to start going to see live noise shows and, you know, see, you know, Bastard Noise, Damon Romero, The Haters, a lot of these characters, the LA FMS scene, you know, and also which a lot of their practice is very much rooted in the same kind of scene I was part of in San Diego, which is, even though they're aware of the greater trends in art and the possibility to have a career as an artist, and some of them are, you know, successful artists or have a career, mm-hmm. it's also just work they create for themselves and for their friends and just that they're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so it's primarily just driven by, you know, pure aesthetics.
Right. Right. Well, that's certainly in step.
That's certainly the case for pretty much all noise, you know.
Right.
As someone said, it's like the ceiling is, you once you start, you've already hit the ceiling.
Right. Right. Well, okay. Well, it's not a hugely popular genre. That is true. But it certainly has its adherents and devotees and enthusiasts, without a doubt. And so at some point in your odyssey, you started what's become a really influential, important, I guess we could call it a noise festival. I mean, it's certainly a festival. It's not exclusively noise, but that seems to be a big part of it. So the End Times Festival. So how did that develop, and did that coincide with you coming to New York, and when did that happen?
Well, I've been here a few years, and let's see, that year, I had multiple people say, you should do a festival. And it just kept happening enough that I was like, geez, the universe is telling me something. And, you know, I used to book shows in San Diego and in L.A., but it had been a while. And so I just kind of thought, why not? And trying to come up with a name, and it was in that period where Fukushima was occurring, and there was this, like, prophet that had predicted the end of the world, and, you know, which didn't happen. But, you know, there's all this kind of stuff going on, and I just thought, End Times, that's an interesting name. And and I found out it had been used for a festival before, but like a one-off, and so I changed it to make it this old-time spelling of,
right,
with the extra E and the Y.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, that's been a really important event every year here in New York. I mean, I know you've done it at some different venues, and of course this past year you've mostly suspended the End Times Festival, or did you do some kind of a version of it? I'm not quite clear.
We did a live stream in June, and then another one in November, where at Hollow, which is where the festival is going to be last April, where we actually had performers in the room using the PA, but it was just like artists and just a couple staff members, and it was really fun, and it was super weird to be performing with the full PA, you know, and feeling that visceral experience again. Mm-hmm. And it was, I was like, it was just deja vu, you know? I think a lot of us had the same experience of just being like, whoa, like, oh, damn, I remember what this is like.
Right.
But then things started, you know, to get a little hectic again with COVID, and so let it expire. I'd like to start picking it up again, but I'm just kind of waiting for the time to be right.
Of course. Okay. So the end times will return at some point, we presume.
Yeah, I'm getting some ideas together about trying to do another live stream, just all pre-recorded. Maybe trying to do a shoot locally with some local artists, and then have some videos from distant, you know, artists.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, good. Well, just one further sort of, I guess, some questions further, a little bit about noise and about the End Times Festival, and about, you know, it seems to me, I mean, there's a lot of different approaches to noise and a lot of different types of presentations, but, you know, what you do and some of the, at least my take of some of the themes of what I've seen over the years at End Times Festival, I guess there's some key concepts about that and keywords that I want to ask you about. I mean, so when you talk about particularly the term liberation and liberation noise or musical liberation, I'm trying to understand how you conceive of noise in that sense, in the sense of a kind of, I mean, I might be stretching here, but when I think about, you know, Naropa and about that kind of mindset, and I think about noise and liberation, I feel like there's a connection there, a kind of a difference, maybe a somewhat unique spin on noise. I mean, not everybody thinks of noise as a kind of liberation force. A lot of people, well, there's a lot of different takes. So I just wanted to throw that out there, see if you had a thought about that. How you arrived at this kind of sort of idea of noise that you present.
Well, there's a few ways that to me it makes sense. In some ways, it's being liberated just by aesthetic forms and, you know, traditional practices and styles and instrumentation. And, you know, as my friend Brian Eubanks put it, it's like creating, you know, noise can be thought of as like creating your own genre, you know, of sound. Like every artist is like their own style of music. That's one form of that. There's also, to me, like the effects that DIY culture has on society at large, that, you know, by being involved in bands and booking shows and making zines and putting out tapes and, you know, corresponding with people, that it leads to, like, both personal and professional skills that can really help people in their, you know, money-making life and in their, you know, their community life. And then there's also like the, it's just like the visceral kind of experience of hearing noise at full volume for the first time, that it can really transform your mind. And I've had this response from my brother once. The first time I started doing the piano feedback work, and he just came over and was just like, listened to it for a while and was like, damn, oh my God. And we were both mourning, you know, that our grandma was passing, and there's a lot of, like, you know, heavy emotions in the air, and he was just like, oh my God, it's what I needed to hear, you know?
Right.
Or a guy that I used to tour with, a choreographer, like him and some of the performers came to see a show, and afterwards they're like, oh my God, it's the only time he wasn't working on his phone while a musician was playing, because he was just like, you know, mouth agape, just kind of like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of, maybe that, is that the Keanu Reeves, you know, whoa factor? I don't know, but sometimes it can just really just short circuit your normal way of working and thinking and the obsessions we have, and that it can, you know, shock you into at least kind of an experience of the present moment.
And is there any, you know, again, I'm presuming a lot here just by this biographical fact of yours, but is there any, you know, is there any connection with noise? And I mean, the way you're describing it right now in our conversation and also my experience of your work, you know, it's kind of an altered state in a sense. And that might describe noise more broadly too. But is there any connection with that and some kind of, you know, idea of mindfulness and, you know, meditative states or anything, you know, some of the same sort of pursuits or some of the same, some of the same things that meditation and Buddhism and that sort of thing are interested in? Is there an overlap here, or is that just a stretch?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly you could think of it that way. It's funny that there's a lot of overlap and connection, and in my experience, and I think in the world at large, between I think psychedelic kind of environments and activities, and then contemplative meditative activities, and a lot of it just comes back to that immediate, you know, experience of the moment and the wowness of life. Mm-hmm. It's just that some are heavily, you know, medicated and narcolated, and some are just by being kind of open and aware without, mm-hmm. you know, at least immediate reaction and definition. Mm-hmm. So, I think that it's certainly the case, you know, in terms of my process of creating sound, that I have ideas and I have a plan, or I think I have at least a starting point and I know roughly how my equipment is supposed to work. But in the moment, I just listen to what's happening and I'm kind of discovering it along the way with everyone else. And that mm-hmm. it's almost like I'm kind of creating the tides and the surf. And then once I get to know it, then I can ride the waves. So. Mm-hmm.
Right. Excellent.
Which takes, you know, a little bit of, you know, some idea what's going to happen, but also just like patience to see how it actually is.
Right. Okay. Well, great. Well, okay. Well, let me just pause here for a moment. It's a little bit after 8:30. So, I just want to, again, welcome our radio audience, and let you know you're listening to the Musical Ecology series on the airwaves tonight. We're coming to you live from the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and I'm speaking here with our guest tonight, Bob Bellaru. And we'll be here with you until 10 p.m. And so we have a mixed evening here. I mean, we've obviously been talking for most of the hour so far, but we have some live music. So I think we're going to kind of go back and forth a little bit. So what do you think, Bob? I mean, it's a little after 8:30. You have some work we want to present in this first hour, some live. So you have a little setup here. Let's just quickly just kind of try to draw a picture here. We have a little tabletop set up with a lot of electronics, computers, foot pedals, and so on. And you have some, why don't you just give us a little sort of sketch of what you're going to present to us?
I mean, I have my same setup I always have with pedals and laptop and some small speakers on the table. And for this first part, I brought more like acoustic objects and some metal. And try to find ways to work with, more of the activity in the room and the room sound. Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens.
Nice. Well, we pretty much have the room to ourselves. I mean, we have a little bit of company tonight. We have an engineer. We have Jackson at the controls, and a little documentation. Lorenzo is here photographing, and then just Bob and I, and just the four of us in this open room here, which we usually have filled with people. So we're doing a safe, socially distanced evening tonight. And so I guess we'll transition over to the music. And I think with the rest of the evening ahead, you know, we'll have a little station break at the top of the hour. And then we'll continue with live music into the second hour. And probably at the end of that, maybe do a recap and talk a little bit more about what we've just heard. And so, again, you're listening to the Musical Ecology series on the airwaves, live from Park Slope, Brooklyn. And if you'd like to learn more about the Musical Ecology series, I invite you to visit our website at musicalecologies.net. And thank you again to Wave Farm for hosting the program. And I guess we'll let me know when you're ready there, Bob. And do you have a title for what we're about to hear, or any kind of working title?
Just macrotonal music.
Of course. Oh, right. Thank you for bringing that up again. Now, that was sort of the title of the evening tonight is macrotonal music, and you know, maybe we'll get into a little bit about what that means later after we've heard some macrotonal music. But so, okay, wonderful. Are you ready to start? Here's Bob Bellaroo live from the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn.